John Joseph Owens has been professor of Old Testament interpretation at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Louisville, since 1942. He was the youngest student in the history of Southern to earn the Doctor of Theology degree. A native of Shawnee, Oklahoma, he graduated from Oklahoma Baptist University and received his Master of Theology and Doctor of Theology from Southern Seminary. He has done graduate work at the University of Manchester in England, the University of Zurich, and the University of Basel, among others. His denominational experience includes serving as pastor of a number of churches. He has been visiting professor at the Baptist Theological Seminary in Ruchlikon, Zurich, Switzerland, and the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary, Beirut, Lebanon. During and shortly after his student days at Oklahoma Baptist University, he was an instructor there. He belongs to a number of academic organizations and has authored many articles and books. He was co-author of The Essentials of Biblical Hebrew with Kyle M. Yates. He has written articles in the books of Numbers and Daniel for the Broadman Commentary.
The canonical book of Job has been regarded by Tennyson as the supreme product of poetic genius. Carlyle said, "There is nothing written, I think, in the Bible or out of it of equal literary merit." Consequently, in literature, both canonical and non-canonical, Job has become recognized as one of the outstanding pieces of literature. The language of the book is Hebrew throughout. The first part of the book is in prose, that is, the historical narrative of the first two chapters. And the last part of the last chapter is also in prose, whereas the center part of the book is clearly in poetry. The date of the book has been given from very, very early to very, very late. The problem within the book, that of suffering, of course, is a universal problem and reaches a great deal of the background of people all over the world. The language itself shows great evidence of various levels of construction, just as skilled archaeologists can see in ruins various stages of development. It is very clearly seen that there are stages of development within the book of Job. For instance, the prologue and the epilogue apparently are the oldest portions and the most established portions. It is very important for us to understand the prologue and the epilogue for the simple reason that this is the material that the writer has seen fit to preserve for us. And in the total compilation of the book, this prologue sets for us the standard basis on which we can interpret the book correctly. I think it should be remembered that Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu in the book did not know as much as you and I can know as we have already read the prologue. Now, the unity of the book is quite well established because there are various threads that run throughout the book. Suffering is a subject that has gone all the way through the book, and consequently, it ties the book together very excellently. Wisdom is another area that is very clear within the book. And so, the content of the book of Job shows a great deal of unity, though there is a great deal of progression in it as well. Now, as far as authorship is concerned, the various levels of the language show some differences, and consequently we can see that the prologue and the epilogue, the oldest part of the story, then we find the dialogue is also another level of construction and probably is later than the prologue. There is some discussion as to whether the wisdom chapter, that is chapter 28, is very ancient and probably predates even the dialogue of the book where the three friends have the dialogue with Job. But the later sections of the book are quite clearly seen in the Elihu speeches as being an addition are later woven into the book, and the Yahweh speeches as well. Probably the author of the book of Job, as we would understand the author, or the one who put it all together in this particular order, used the prologue and the epilogue and the wisdom chapter as the basis around which to wind the entire book. And then the dialogue was placed there. Then the Elihu speeches and the Yahweh speeches form conclusions for that particular entire thought. I said that the book of Job is listed as wisdom literature. The purest of wisdom is in chapter 28, which we will look at in a few minutes. Wisdom literature is common to a lot of various types of languages and cultures. Generally, wisdom literature is not as formal in its religion as the prophetic or the legalistic portions of our scripture. The wisdom literature looks at life in a more practical, and at times then the speakers within wisdom literature are more theoretical. Actually, in this particular segment of wisdom literature, you can ask the question, how does one face a problem? Some people have said that suffering is the problem that is looked at within the book. But really, the book does not answer the problem of suffering, and consequently, since there is no real answer to that particular problem, it appears to me that this is not the essential problem of the book. But rather, there is something else that is more essential, and that is wisdom. And as man, whether religious or non-religious, is called upon to face various problems, whether it be suffering, whether it be the problems within the family, or the problems of economy, or the problems of facing death, the way one faces problem becomes very important. And so the literary format that you look at here can be put around two basic poles. One is, and this is the basic approach that I think I see within the three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that is, in the form of a controversy. The Hebrew word reev is somewhat the idea of a lawsuit and a controversy. And in such case, someone has to be counted as being in the right, and someone has to be in the wrong. And it is absolutely necessary that someone be blamed. This seems to be one of the weaknesses of human nature, and that is, in every kind of problem, somebody must be blamed. Thus, when Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar approach the problem that Job is facing, they approach it as one very interested in Job, as well as very interested in any kind of problem, and they are anxious to find out who the enemy is, they are anxious to find out who the judge is, and then they are also desirous of proclaiming the source and also the culprit of any kind of evil. Thus, in the controversy, they are seeking to say one is right or righteous and one is wrong or to be blamed. Now, the other approach to facing the problem may be called the approach of lament. In this case, we find Job is struggling to maintain this very approach. He maintains his integrity, his wholeness, his righteousness. But Job is somewhat different from the three friends. Job does not see the need to blame. In the lament form that we find in the Psalms, for instance, one can maintain his innocence, and yet at the same time he vows that he will offer a gift when this particular problem is followed. Now, there is a slight difference that some people would make. Some would say, just live in faith without any need to examine the various factors, such as man's philosophy or man's theology or his own relationship to it. Now, Job is one different from his friends in the book. He is seeking to re-examine himself, re-examine his philosophy, and even examine his theology. The poetry in Hebrew is somewhat different from other poetry. You see that parallelism is more important than rhyme in understanding Hebrew poetry. One looks at the number of heavy metric divisions, but really, poetry in Hebrew stands on having separate lines basically saying the same thing or building upon the original thought. You see, for instance, in most of the verses throughout the center portion of the book, that in one line the author says one thing, and then in the second line he repeats in different words the same basic thought. Now, you may also have in parallelism not only of the two portions of a verse being parallel to each other, but then you may have verses parallel to each other, or you may have sections parallel to each other. For instance, in the larger area, you find in the prologue, for instance, that there are two of the trials placed upon Job by the adversary, one that's called Satan within the book. Likewise, you find another parallel, that is, you find a dialogue with the friends, that is, Job makes the opening speech, and then Eliphaz makes a speech, and Job answers, then Bildad makes a speech, and Job answers, and then Zophar makes a speech, and Job answers. And in this particular dialogue, you proceed to see it going into three basic cycles. Then in the latter portion of the book, you find that Yahweh makes a speech and Job comes back to give some kind of retort. And then Yahweh makes another speech and Job comes in and makes another retort. And thus you see a parallel between the friend's dialogue and then the dialogue with Yahweh. Another parallel that you find in the book is that in the central portion of the book of Job, basically chapters 27 through 31, you will find what seems to approach a real conclusion. Very, very similar to what you find in the speeches of Yahweh in chapters 38 to 42. I'm using the term Yahweh as the proper pronunciation of the distinct covenant name of the God of the Hebrews. In the Revised Standard Version, it is generally translated Lord with a capital L. In some other translations, you'll find the word Jehovah, but actually there was no such word as Jehovah until approximately the 13th century A.D., and the correct pronunciation of the divine name is Yahweh. Y-A-H-W-E-H, or sometimes spelled J-A-H-V-E-H, but in either case it is pronounced as Yahweh, or as the Israeli pronunciation would make it Yahweh. The other parallel that you find is that Elihu's speeches, you find basically four of them, could very well be one, his first speech, a parallel to the first cycle, and then his second speech, a parallel to the second cycle, and the third speech as parallel to the third cycle, and then the fourth speech is parallel to Job's speeches. It is very difficult to understand why all of these speeches of Elihu are placed together unless the author wanted to use them here as the bridge between the rigidity of the thought of the three friends and the freer thought and the higher estimate which Yahweh will bring. Now, much literature outside of the Hebrews has this common theme of suffering, and within the wisdom pattern, and also with the prologue and the epilogue in prose, whereas the center part of the book is in poetry. Now, the theme found in the book, there are two verses that stand out for me. In the prologue, in the ninth verse of the first chapter, it reads, "Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Does Job fear God for naught?'" In the Hebrew, the thing that is most to be emphasized is the word for naught. That is to say, is it for nothing that Job fears God? Basically asking the question that isn't Job religious for what he can get out of it? Now, this seems to be a fundamental idea that must be held all the way through. Then the verse that you find in chapter 4 and verse 17, in that particular chapter, it comes out of the mouth of Eliphaz when he says, "Can mortal man be righteous before God? Can a man be pure before his maker?" Here you can see a good example of parallelism indicating the Hebrew poetry. Can man be righteous before God? Now, some would translate this, can man be more righteous than God? But I think, really, he's saying in the presence of God, can man even claim a righteousness? This verse also can be seen underlying Job's speech in chapter 9, verse 2. Bildad also makes a retort here in chapter 25, verse 4. I said that suffering really was not the real problem that was being examined in the book, though it really runs all the way through the book. I have a general idea that one of the purposes of the book is what wisdom can give man the answer that he needs, using suffering as the utensil. I think this makes it a very practical book. If the book is a book of wisdom literature, as all scholars indicate, then what type of wisdom can give man the answer that he needs? When we examine the background of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, we can understand a little bit about these various kinds of wisdom. Now, the characters within the book, of course, are Job, a man who is righteous, a man who maintains his integrity, who is blameless, upright, a fearer of God, and one who turns away from evil. We'll examine him a little more completely later on. The children, there are 7 sons and 3 daughters. This makes 10 children altogether. 10 is a good round figure in Hebrew. The sons of God, who are there in the heavenly council, as recorded in the prologue, are quite important. And the one that is in the translation called Satan. I prefer to translate this as the adversary in each case, rather than the proper name, because here the adversary comes into the presence of God, and so the prologue clearly has the time before the devil appears, that is, the idea of the evil one being a fallen angel, for here he comes along with the sons of God. And the word is clearly not the proper name that you find in First Chronicles, but it is rather with the article, and thus I prefer to use the idea the adversary all the way along. Then you find Job's wife. Now, a lot of people make some point about Job's wife. There is much tradition about her. Generally, the tradition is built off of the ancient view of woman and the position of Eve in the account of creation. But we know so little about Job's wife out of the prologue that it is not really possible for us to make a psychological study. It is true that she comes into the book and says in verse 9 of chapter 2, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Well, this is giving Job a way out of his problem, which he does not receive. And he says that her speech was like one of the foolish women. But it does not say that she was not a supporter of Job, and does not say that she was a foolish woman, but merely that this is the way that the foolish people would get out of the problem. Then the 3 friends are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Eliphaz is a Temanite, that is, he comes from Edom, and Edom was very famous for its wisdom. Edom would be south of Palestine. He was a man with great weight and originality. His speeches were well composed and judicial. In fact, they were too coldly academic, Job thinks. But when abstractly considered, they would be full of good religious counsel. one must be very careful in interpreting the speeches of these three friends, that he interprets them from their basic philosophy and not from the total theology of the Scripture. The second friend is Bildad, who was from Shua. That is, he was a Shuhite. Now, Shua is generally the east or southeast of Palestine. It would be a far distant region. The name contains some reference to a Babylonian deity, and consequently it seems to represent the wisdom of the distant east. Bildad appeals to tradition. He is the last one of the three friends to give any kind of speech, as he is generally the one that speaks second in the various cycles. And yet he is a scholar who is well-versed in the derived lore of tradition. Zophar is a Naamathite. I class him as a zealot. That is, he was very, very zealous. In fact, he rebukes Job's presumption so much about trying to find out these unsearchable secrets of God. And he is the first one to accuse Job directly of wickedness. He is so intense that it almost amounts to reckless exaggeration, some of the things that he says with all of his passionate responses. He's very dogmatic. Now, Naamah may be in Palestine, but since all of the other locations are outside of Palestine, I feel that really he was from the west or towards Asia Minor. And thus Eliphaz would represent the southern, that is the traditional Edomite wisdom. Bildad would represent the eastern wisdom, whereas Zophar would represent the western type of wisdom. Now, when I say western, I don't mean American or United States. I mean the west of Palestine. Elihu, or sometimes pronounced Elihu, Elihu is younger than probably all four of the first who speak. He is very intense, but he is young enough to really spring forth to want to give different understandings. Yahweh is the divine God of the Hebrews. You'll have to be very careful now in the understanding of which God is being spoken of. Most of the time within the book of Job, it is the general word for God, Elohim. But in the prologue and in the Yahweh speeches, you find this distinct Yahweh approach. And so again, we see the approach in the wisdom of outside of the Hebrews, and then the wisdom which would be under the Hebraic understanding of God. Now, the outline of the book is very, very clear. The first two chapters, the prologue, then in chapter 3 through chapter 27 is the dialogue. In this dialogue, we see basically three cycles. That is, Job opens the entire approach. The third chapter of the book is the opening speech, which we may call Job's lament. Then Eliphaz makes his first speech in chapter 5. Job replies to this in chapter 6 and 7. Bildad makes his first speech in chapter 8, and Job replies to this in chapters 9 and 10. Zophar makes his first speech in chapter 11, and then Job replies in chapters 12, 13, and 14. Now, it should be noted that when Job replies to Eliphaz, or to Bildad, or Zophar, he is not replying to their former speech, but rather they are working around the problem of wisdom and how does suffering enter into the particular wisdom. Now, beginning with chapter 15, you find the second cycle of speeches. Eliphaz makes his second speech in chapter 15. Job makes the fourth reply in chapter 16 and 17. Bildad makes his second speech in chapter 18. Then Job makes his fifth reply in chapter 19. Zophar makes his second speech in chapter 20. And Job makes the sixth reply in chapter 21, completing the second cycle. The third cycle is not a complete cycle. Eliphaz makes his third speech in chapter 22, and Job makes the reply, his seventh reply, now in chapter 23. Then in chapter 24, there is a speech of delayed judgment, which follows Job's seventh reply. Scholars are of differing here as to whether this is to part of Job's seventh reply, or whether this is an insert is centered on of delayed judgment. The thoughts that Bildad makes, first time Bildad speaks in the third hole, is in chapter 24. You'll notice that there are only six verses in that particular chapter, and it's rather chopped. And then the eighth reply. Zophar won't come in to the cycle at all. Won't say that there has been lawless speech here of war, and the lawless part of Bildad's speech is liberated. The book stands. Appears to me Bildad really doesn't have anything to say. He did not anything real different and new in the word cycle at all. And consequently, the argument floundered because it was not reaching kind of understanding Job's part, and they really run out of any kind of argument at all. So did not the third cycle. Then we find the third unit following the prologue. What is clear? The Job speeches. Where the Job speeches began may be debatable. After all, Job's eighth reply, chapter 26. Now, the Job speeches may be chapters 27, chapter 31. Or it may be his eighth reply is chapters 27, and then the Job speeches to begin later on. I am quite parallel to the idea of righteous, but it is not the same word. This is yasher, which means to be straight, and consequently to be upright. He was one who continuously feared God. This is a participial expression which means without interruption. He was continuously fearing God. Now, the word fear basically is the idea to worship, to have the proper understanding of, the proper relationship to. He was one who worshiped, who feared. He was one who continuously turned away from evil. That is, he would not let evil stand in his way, and he would not involve himself with it. Now, this statement is made about Job three times, and so it must be quite important for us to understand the estimation of Job was that Job was what he claimed to be. Job regularly maintained his integrity. Now, this is the word quite regularly that is translated blameless. He intended to maintain his innocence, for he was convinced that he was seeking to be what God wanted him to be. Now, he had great possessions. He had a large family. He had large possessions, which showed clearly his status in life. For instance, the possession of 3,000 camels in that particular territory would have marked him as among the elite. He had 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses. He had a huge source of working animal. He also had many servants, and so he was a man who had great status and great possessions. Now also, he was a man who was very effective in his religious influence. His family was very closely related to him. For instance, when the sons had a feast, they invited the three sisters, which showed a very closeness within the family.
Now, one of the verses that has given a lot of people a problem is the verse 5, when it says, "And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them." Now notice, Job would send. This means to me that Job would send for the children. Now, it does not say whether it was the seven sons and the three daughters, or merely the seven sons, but he would send for the children. And this is clearly the concept that they would answer and come. And after they came, he would sanctify them, that is, he would prepare them for coming into the practice of sacrifice. Now, he would rise up early in the morning and offer a burnt offering according to the number of them all. For Job said, now the English translations generally give his statement as, quote, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." There are no quotation marks in the Hebrew Old Testament, and consequently, the translator must find where the quotation ends. Now, the word cursed is the same word that is translated bless. The word barak, which is translated bless, is used somewhat as the English word bless is. You can either bless people or you can bless them out. And consequently, you can curse or bless according to the context of the word. Now, it appears to me, from the syntax of the Hebrew, that the word send and sanctify and curse are of the form that would tie these together. And thus, the quotation, as I understand it, is that Job offered these sacrifices, for he said, quote, "It may be that my sons have sinned," end quote. Now, he did not go off into a region by himself and just offer a sacrifice, just hoping that maybe it would cover their sins, but rather he had sent for them, and they were there, and they were involved with him. Now, notice, Job the patriarch is performing as the priest. This indicates a very ancient time with the Hebrews, before the priest was really in the position of offering the sacrifice. And so the patriarch hears the priest and shows the antiquity of the account. Now, after the children had come, Job, for the case of the sinning that the children may have done, he offered the sacrifice. And that being so, the children blessed God, not cursed, blessed God in their hearts. I think since Job is being painted here in the prologue as a man who was a fearer of God and who was very, very influential, we see that Job was effective in his family relationship, not only that the sons would invite the sisters as they would have the feast in their home, but also that because Job was so sincere and effective in his religion, the children in their hearts blessed God. Thus I would read that verse, for Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned." And as sure as he did that, the children blessed God in their hearts. Now, in verse 6, we come to this particular problem of the sons of God coming to present themselves before the Lord. Now, this is the sons of Elohim. This is the sons of God. This would be a phrase that could be used about angels, about the heavenly council. It appears to me that this is really the idea of the heavenly council. Or it could be that these of the class of gods, for in that ancient time, of course, the idea of having other gods known was quite clear. For instance, in the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." This was in their vocabulary. And so the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Some say that they came to present themselves just as a normal routine. Some say that they were coming to report what they had seen on their particular routine duty. But the Hebrew expression here may mean that the sons of God came to situate themselves against Yahweh. This is precisely the same term, the same two Hebrew words that are used in the second Psalm when the kings of earth set themselves against Yahweh and his anointed. And so this may have been somewhat of a struggle in the heavenly council for identifying who the real divine authority was. remember that this book is prior to the time that the evil one, Satan, eventually we come to see the devil, was, this was prior to the time that he was seen as a fallen angel. And so there may have been some kind of struggle pictured here. Now, it is Yahweh that says to the adversary, "Have you considered my servant Job?" The adversary did not bring up Job to Yahweh, but Yahweh had such confidence, knowing that Job was blameless and upright, a fearer of God and one who turned away from evil, he knew his servant Job to be effective. So then the adversary answers Yahweh and he says, "Well now, Job doesn't serve God for nothing, does he?" And he says, "You," emphasizing you, "put a hedge about him and you've got everything that he's got under control. You've blessed the work of his hands." The adversary says, "Now you take away everything he's got and he'll really bless you out to your face." And so Yahweh is very free in saying, "Go right ahead." And so Job loses everything he's got. He loses all of his possessions. And in all of this, Job did not accuse God of doing anything foolish or did not charge God with folly. But rather, verse 20 of chapter 1 says, "He arose, he rent his robe, shaved his head, fell upon the ground and worshipped." He laid himself subject to his God. He entered into the experience of mourning and of worship. And he said, "Now the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Let keep on being blessed the name of the Lord." Then in the parallel, we find that the adversary comes back and says, "Skin for skin." Now this is a very difficult verse in verse 4 of chapter 2. It may be that layer after skin, that is, after you strip off all on the outside, Job would give up anything just in order to save the inside, the inner man. Or since he was now going to be covered with loathsome sores and would be scraping himself, it could be that you scrape off the outside to get down to the inner man. And thus, skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But again, Yahweh says to the adversary, "He's in your power, only don't touch his very life itself." Now, when Job was suffering so much with these loathsome sores from the top of his head to the sole of his feet, he took a broken pot and scraped himself. Sitting among the ashes, he was somewhat segregated out there. And his wife gives him a way of committing theological suicide. When she says, "Do you still hold fast your integrity?" Of course he was holding it fast. Then she says, "Curse God and die. Get out of this particular problem." And Job says, "Why, you speak as one of those foolish women. We're not just trying to get out of this particular problem. What is the answer to the problem?" Now, having raised this, when he shows that he would not seek to get something good with which to serve God, the three friends appear on the scene. Now, these three friends came from long distance. Job had been suffering for a good long while now. And so these three friends come. But verse 12 of chapter 2 says they did not recognize him. This seems very strange to me, even though I'm sure the suffering had disfigured Job some. The same word translated recognize could very easily be translated, and they did not treat him as a stranger. That is, they were seriously involved in the problem with him. Now, having seen that Job does not serve God just for what he can get out of it, we turn to the 12 places that Job's speeches reveal a change in the attitude from that of the three friends. Job starts in chapter 3, and the book starts by saying, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth." Now, this is not the way we would understand cursing. The actual translation would be something to the extent that he made light of. He treated it as insignificant. It is not the word damned as we would understand it in theological terminology. Job makes the opening speech in which it reveals how deep his suffering really is. Eliphaz says that man cannot be righteous before God. Then in chapter 6 and verse 24, we find Job making what I would class now as the first of the advances. In the 24th verse of the 6th chapter, he says, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have erred." Here, Job is saying that he is willing to change, whereas the three friends are not willing to change. But Job says, "Teach me, I will be silent." It's very clear that the attitude of the three friends stays the same all the way through. They hold on to their philosophy of suffering is the result of sin, prosperity is the result of righteousness. And they're rigid on this view. Job breaks with that philosophy of the ancient Near East. The second highlight, as I would see it, in Job's development, or his trick of theology, is found in chapter 9, verse 22, when he has maintained that, "Though I am innocent, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse." Here again you see a beautiful example of parallelism. Verse 22 says, "It is all one. Therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked." Now, he is pointing up the philosophy of his friends here in their saying that if man is righteous, he then has the result of friendship of God and thus prosperity. If he sins, then he must be punished. But Job says, "I am innocent. I am standing before God, and I say that he destroys both those that are prosperous and those that are suffering." He is somehow now examining, since he stands on the case that his life is a life of righteousness and he is suffering, that the wires of the philosophy of these three friends now have been short-circuited. Then he proceeds in his thought into chapter 14, which is in one of his later speeches, his third reply, actually. And in chapter 14, that beautiful verse that really permits the voice of the grave to start speaking, it sets the foundation which eventually develops into the idea of Christian immortality. When he says, "If a man die, shall he live again?" Job's logic is that he is very, very close to death. Now, the Hebrew idea of death is not cessation, as we often think it is, but it is rather devitalization. And Job is being weakened so greatly here that he sees himself very close to death, and he does not see any vindication on the horizon. And thus, he is sure that there is going to be some vindication, for he is sure of his blamelessness, his innocence, and yet there's got to be a judgment and a justice to come forth out of his experience. So he says, "If a man die..." Now, really, there is no if to man's death. For in verse 10 of chapter 14, he says, "But man dies and is laid low. Man breathes his last, and where is he?" So there is no question about man's death. So I think this particular verse should be translated like this: "When a man dies, may he live again." And thus he opens the question, is the grave cessation? Is the death the end? And here the voice from across the line of death begins to be heard, which eventually will involve in the later understanding which you find in a portion of Isaiah and in the book of Daniel about the resurrection. When a man dies, may he live again. The fourth of the advances are the thoughts that Job seems to center in his thought is in chapter 16, verse 11, and also echoed down in verse 19. Verse 11 says, "God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, and he broke me asunder. And then in verse 19, even now, behold, my witness is in heaven. Or in verse 20, he says, my eye pours out tears to God. Now, Job is saying that he has some adversaries. This chapter is so clearly written that both the adversary that we saw in chapters 1 and 2, the prologue, and also the miserable comforters, that is, the three friends, may be wrapped up very close into one concept. And God gives me to the ungodly. He is not identifying exactly who the ungodly is. And so you may have here somewhat of a paranomasia, that is, a double meaning, in which it's both to these miserable comforting friends of his and also to the evil power. But regardless of who caused his suffering, regardless of the one who had really given him problems, Job says, my witness is in heaven. He is saying to these friends, now you have your philosophy and you are making the answers on the basis of your philosophy as though everything is right here among humanity. But the fact of the matter is, my witness is in heaven. Job is wanting a confrontation with God. Job gets a little bit impatient, but what human being would not get impatient after the months and perhaps years of intense suffering and then this sort of comforting? At times, it appears that Job slips a little bit over into the controversy pattern of the three friends. For as he has been maintaining his innocence and thus holding on to his lament, at times they goad him almost into approaching the problem from their standpoint. Then the fifth of the advances you find in chapter 19 and verse 25, fitting with this statement of chapter 16, my wickedness is in heaven. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. Then in verse 29, that you may know there is a judgment. Now the basic statement here, the real emphatic thing that is to be seen is, I know that my Redeemer lives. The rest of this text is very difficult to interpret and translate. It's easier for us to see after we have the Christian idea of immortality or resurrection. But remember, Job did not have this concept, and the revelation is beginning to come through him or into him. His main conviction here, according to the grammatical divisions, is, I know that my Redeemer lives. He is not left to the presence of these friends. The sixth is in chapter 21, basically in verses 7 and 26. Verse 7 says, why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Now here he is knocking into oblivion the philosophy of the three friends, if it is applied all the way across the board to every human experience. For he asked the question. Now, if you say the wicked man, the man that sins, suffers, tell me, how in the world can a wicked man live and reach old age and grow mighty in power? Where in the world is he suffering? He comes down in verse 26 then to say, they lie down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. In other words, their idea of sin causes suffering, but righteousness causes prosperity, just does not fit with experience, either of Job or of the sinful. So as he continues to answer the problem, now repeatedly through the book, you'll find that it says, then Bildad answered, or Job answered. Now, I think they are responding to the problem and not to the previous speech. the seventh in chapter 23 and verse 10. He says, "But he knows, that is, God knows, the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Job is longing for a confrontation with God. For he said in verse 8 of chapter 23, "Behold, I go forward, and he's not there, backward, and I cannot perceive him. On the left hand I seek him, but I cannot behold him. I turn to the right hand, but I cannot see him." Even though he cannot find God, then he would like to have this confrontation with God, because he has the conviction that God is really a just God and God is the judge. Here he says, "He knows the way that I take." I know he knows, but I sure would like for him to come and give us a confrontation. The eighth we find in chapter 26 and verse 14. "Lo, these are but the outskirts of his ways. And how small a whisper do we hear of him? But the thunder of his power, who can understand?" Now, with his conviction that God really is there, and that God, his witness, is in heaven, here he says, "But now, look, we know just very little about God. When we talk about all that we can see, the pillars of heaven, the moon, the clouds, when we talk about all of this, well, these are just portions of the ways of God. And we only have, in comparison to the totality of God, we can only hear a whisper. But the thunder of his power, if we had it all, we couldn't understand it." In other words, Job is getting right close here to one of the conclusions, really, of the book, that man's knowledge, as he himself experiences and sees it, is really not as complete as it ought to be. The tenth is in chapter 28, this glorious wisdom hymn, in which he asks the question, "Where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding?" Then he answers it, "Man does not know the way to it, but God does. You can't buy it. It cannot be gotten for gold. And consequently, where is wisdom?" Then the 28th verse is a marvelous height. "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." In Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, and chapter 9, verse 10, you find it, "The fear of the Lord, that is the beginning of wisdom." Or in Proverbs 15:33, "The fear of the Lord, that is the instruction in wisdom." But here, "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom." And so he is relating what we found in the prologue, is the fear of God, the right worship and the right relationship with God, that is wisdom. And here you find almost the answer to the book. The 11th of these you find in chapter 40, verses 3 through 5, in which Job comes back to something that he had said back in chapter 26, verse 14. "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further." Job is saying, "I don't know enough. My wisdom is not sufficient to answer the problems." Then in chapter 42, verses 3 and 6, we find the 12th of these advances. "Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job comes to the point of saying man's experience is not sufficient. Now, I think the real book answers this. The wisdom of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar is not sufficient. Man's wisdom cannot answer his problems. And Job comes in the wisdom section and in also the final conclusion of the book to say that actually the wisdom of the Lord is the only place that man can find the answers to his problems.